is Dre, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and DR talking about, there was so much going on this last week, y'all, with regard to race and justice. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People.
Family, welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. I am Diara Ballinger. You can find me on Instagram at Diara Ballinger.
My name is Miles E. Johnson. You can find me on Instagram at Pharaoh Rapture.
And this is Dre at DRAY on Twitter.
There's so much going on. There's so much commentary. There's so much response to the commentary. And then apologies, maybe not apologies. I think with Donald Trump, he just doubles down. But Dre, what were you saying about Trump's comments? He's still, I mean, we were talking about this right before the podcast started, how he still says illegal aliens, which is just so mind-blowing to me that I guess it shouldn't be. Nothing should be a shocker with this man. But I guess what is a shock is that people use this term. Miles is seeing it a lot in television commercials there. So, but can you, Dre, can you just dig into the, I'm not exactly sure what he said.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by it because what he said this weekend was, quote, "They're taking your jobs. Every job produced in this country over the last 2 years has gone to illegal aliens. Every job." And it's like, okay, well, not only as a matter of fact is that just not true, and in no world is that true, but it is really interesting the way that he mobilizes like the core tenets of white supremacy to scare people. And I was talking to a close friend over the weekend who is trying to get somebody who is left and black to get off the fence about Kamala. And they had started to repeat this idea that, well, it wasn't all immigrants, but like people are taking jobs away from black people. And you're like, and in real time, I could see how the extreme comments of Trump normalized this sense of like theft in the workplace and da 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 da. And it is just sort of wild to see. And well, Kamala doesn't get to name white supremacy, right? He gets to be racist and xenophobic. He gets to say black jobs and illegal da 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 Haitians. And if she said, you know, like only white men could ever do this, people would lose their minds. But it was interesting to me to just see the statement that was so overblown and so untrue just get repeated as like a, you know, the news just reported it out as like a thing Trump said. And you're like, it just is fascinating to me.
Right. And I think you're absolutely right, Dere, specifically when I think about how big Trump's comments are, and they're heavy and they're big, and they kind of just start these really racist dialogues, and they do kind of trickle down. So now we're talking about something that could be a total lie just because he entered it into the sphere of discussion. And now we're all trying to either correct or negotiate these like extremely racist talking points.
I just also feel like, is anybody thinking or reading? We talked about literacy a couple of weeks ago. I feel like people make these pronouncements, like they just say, well, this thing is true, but it's like based off what are you talking about? Like, what are you talking about? And even just stepping back, like, hey, DeRay's friend, like, do you know what sectors black people most work in? Do you know how many black people are actually employed by black owned businesses? Like, it's like, can we just do some analytical deep thinking around what we're talking about instead of just deciding that you have an opinion that you have to be right about? I don't know if it's psychological. I don't know if it's pathological, but I'm over it.
I was just going to say, I'm glad that Vice President Harris talked about that in the debate between Trump and her, and she mapped out what his plan was, and like, he's gonna start talking about immigration, and she really mapped out what his strategy was, because I do feel like if you listen to her say that, he's doing exactly what she said he would do, which means, which gives me a hint and a half that she's on to something. So hopefully that's also illuminating to other people too, seeing that he's actually doing the racist playbook that she named.
Yeah, and then she's on to is white supremacy, right? It's like, well, it's like they only have one strategy, which is like lie, divide people around issues of race, convince people of things that are not true, make them think they're true. Like it's, but she can't actually say that part out loud, whereas he gets away with saying all types of stuff. It just is, wah. You know, the other thing about abortion, I was talking to black people over the weekend too, and it is interesting to see people who I know would want to be able to choose to have an abortion or have gotten one and suddenly are conservative about the issue. I don't get it, you know? And I was fighting with somebody about Trump's comment about afterbirth abortions, which is not a thing. And the person was like, yeah, well, but sometimes they happen really late. And I'm like, okay, well, after birth and later than you want them are two wildly different things, you know? And then somebody else said to me, well, you know, I'm more socially conservative than Kamala, and Kamala talks so much about social issues. And I'm up here like, does she talk about social issues? Because let's be clear, the only plans she's really rolled out are the economy. I don't know what she said about criminal justice. I don't know what she said about, and this is not a critique of her even in that way, but they're like, you know, what has she said about LGBTQ besides the fact that she married gay people when she was, you know, the San Francisco DA and the attorney general. I say all that to say that, like, it's so interesting how people have twisted themselves into knots to not support her up against somebody who actually has said a whole lot of things about a whole lot of things, and they're wild. I don't get it.
Right.
Moving on to things we don't understand. Janet, Miss Nasty. Miss Jackson, if you're nasty. First of all, I want to say something because we have been so in the throes of this election and all of sort of the social justice, all the issues going on. You know, we have a group chat that we throw in things all the time. And I put in the chat the other day that Tito Jackson died. R.I.P. Tito. And I had no idea. I had no idea. Anyway, I, you know, obviously had a moment of silence to myself around Tito. And maybe just got lost in like the Frankie Beverly of it. Or and people were like, Tito who?
James Earl Jones.
But, and James Earl Jones. Exactly. All these icons that we've lost. And then a couple days ago, 2 days ago, Janet put out, she was being interviewed. And in the interview, first of all, I love Janet Jackson. Love. We all know I have roots in Minnesota. And Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis have been her longtime producers for forever. So I consider her a Minnesotan.
She changed the way I count with my fingers.
Come on.
I do the two.
Come on. Come on.
Yeah.
So Janet said in an interview, I heard someone asked her a question about Kamala, and she said, I heard that her dad is white and that I just know with this election there's going to be chaos. And then this got blown up and it was everywhere. I mean, everywhere where I put my black brain to receive news. maybe not everywhere. But then she, a couple of days later, she like sort of issued some sort of apology around it. But I just...
That wasn't authorized that they took back.
Is that what happened?
That's what happened.
DR, they took it back and then fired the guy who released the statement. He is releasing statements.
They said, we I love said that. That part.
I did. Yes. I did. Because for me, I was like, I want to close the door on this. Like, I don't want to talk about this anymore.
She said, open that door back up.
I mean,
Miles, I've been waiting for your commentary on this, Miles. What say you?
It's so wild. So just, I am not agnostic in this situation. I am a Janet Jackson believer. Rhythm Nation, that's the way love goes. I just saw her a month ago for the second time. So I'm disappointed, you know, first things always first, why are we asking Janet Jackson, as velvety and whispery as her voices are, as clean as that choreography is, that Rhythm Nation was a great album, make you a political pundit not. Why are we asking Janet what's going on? So I'm always going to just question why we're asking celebrities so many questions about our politics. My other thing, though, is she's such a good example of being algorithmized. Mm-hmm. That's a made up word. Mm-hmm. Or being red pilled. And I think sometimes it doesn't always happen with how we imagine it happening. So a lot of times we'll talk about this young boy who's on the internet, and before you know it, he's trying to learn how to date somebody, or he's trying to learn how to do muscles or cars or whatever. You know, have not had that intimate experience of young boyhood in that way. But you're on the internet, and then before you know it, you're being fed conservative ideas, and now you are being socialized into this extreme conservatism. That's not the exclusive way misinformation and disinformation spreads and how people get socialized to think certain wild conspiracy theories. It often happens with somebody else. The rumor is that somebody else is Randy Jackson, has consumed all these conspiracy theories, has almost encyclopedic knowledge of the trash, and then just has regular conversations with Janet. And because you're able to speak, you ever see Candace Owens speak, how she can't even take a breath? The lies that she says, and it's so convincing that if you're not a smarter person, or even in my case, I don't know if I'm a smarter person, but I'm a more spiteful person. So I know I don't want to believe Candace Owens. So I'm questioning every sentence and I'm Googling everything because I want her to be wrong. But if you don't go in with that spite that I have, it's easy to repeat that and then get somebody else to agree, specifically somebody else who has a baby who's in their 50s and who's on a world tour. And, you know, it's an invisible cult. It's an invisible Jonestown, but it's a Jonestown still the same, in my opinion.
The only thing I'll say is that it's interesting because, as we all know, there's a responsibility that comes with the big platform. I'm surprised she said it so casually. It wasn't like there was a hidden microphone or somebody overheard her talking. She said it to a reporter. And yeah, just as all this, with Black people and Trump, I'll tell you, you know, I think the second go round of a Trump administration would be cataclysmically worse than the first one. And that's saying something, because the first one was rough. And, you know, Reconstruction is the period of American history that tells us that being Black and rich means nothing when white supremacy decides it means nothing. And there's a whole set of people, while I'm interested in that history lesson, I don't want to live that. I want to read about Reconstruction and I want to keep it pushing. I do not want to relive what happened during Reconstruction. Because remember, the only way that the period of Black prosperity happened is because the United States government installed the army in the South. And I do think that the Biden administration, and thank God he is an old white man because he could actually do it. I think when Trump loses, all hell's going to break loose. I think that their side is going to play dirty and nasty. And I think that Biden might have to do what we did during the Reconstruction era, mobilize the National Guard. Like, I think it actually might come there because Trump knows he's not going to win. The game is to cheat and steal it. And I think that Biden has a responsibility to do what's right to make sure that doesn't happen. Insert Reconstruction here.
I'll just say one last thing on Janet Jackson. We have to also present that Rhythm Nation was actually about like a late 80s style sort of solidarity, creative expression, equality. Like, we didn't have language for the language we have now. We didn't have it back then.
But that's what Rhythm Nation. No. She said in this one, she said, they said racism. No. Homophobia. No.
No.
And then they danced with their arms.
Well, that's it. I actually feel like we have to do a better job with being in touch with folks like Janet Jackson to offer real information, right? Because what happens is this, this is just because I don't want anybody that has helped to shape me in my life out there talking crazy. I don't care if it's my auntie or if it's Janet Jackson, period. You know? So I think I am I'm putting too much on it, but that's the person that I am. But we can move on. Too bad we're moving on to Diddy. I don't want to talk about him.
I just want to say one little small thing about Janet. A little small thing about Janet. Because she is in a celebrity class. So I know that we're all in the same race, but if Janet is not being touched by the right information, it's because she has made it so she cannot be touched. She's the one who can't be touched, and she's been insulated. So yeah, I really feel that way. Fair. And then if we look at it, and I love Janet, and I really hope there's no like weird fan bases who overhear this, but you know, Paris Jackson, Michael's kids, those like accusations with Michael, I think even like you know what we know about her about her father. Janet Jackson has been engaged with patriarchal forces, either victimized by them or having to be silenced by them, and that shifts your brain. And then when you add the prison of fame and money to that to make it so you don't have to evolve intellectually, because we're going to ask you about your kids. We are. If you come to the cookout, we're going to be like, Janet,
what's going on?
Yeah. So whose parents is
but
real?
That, but just, I feel like that's us, a fair... this is the conversation that I want to be... I really my new practice is to try to get out of my petty and to really think expansively and compassionately with people and just to do deeper dives on them instead of being like, no, thank you. Some people are going to be no thank yous, by the way. I still have clearly work to do, but
it's anyway. Funny how the politics fly when you're on a private jet. Funny how the politics
that part.
Now that's a segue to Diddy.
That is a segue to Diddy.
What did you all think about everything that was dropping this weekend? I have to be like really honest.
I've been following it. Like what has been dropping? Like,
well, you know, DeRay's on the Diddy beat. Every single time I think I'm on it, DeRay's like, well, his mama's sister cousin two times.
Well, I did love Shine's commentary. Also, Shine, wow. Somebody give me a ride to Belize. Good gracious.
Listen. Mm-hmm.
Can he be a guest on the podcast?
That is a fine black man.
I was algorithmized or whatever it's called. Right. By Diddy sub, because baby, I turn around and it's Diddy is the whole timeline. Is Diddy in that show Monsters on Netflix, which I'm not seeing yet? Monsters. That's my whole
about
timeline.
About the Menendez right brother.
About the Menendez brothers, yeah. The Diddy stuff is interesting because I do think that there's sort of like a weird desire to see all the materials that is happening on the internet. I think that is true. And absolutely. I think that there is, there's this belief that, and I do believe this part, that it's impossible for Diddy to have done even a quarter of what they said and people not know. Right. That like, it just couldn't have happened. So the question becomes, who else knew? And what is their culpability in this? I'm interested in that. Now, I don't think this goes to trial. I cannot imagine it going to trial. If not only because everything would be unsealed or wildly public, or I just can't imagine. But Diddy's ego, you know, he was able to get away with it for a whole lifetime, that I could see him trying to fight this in court. But, you know, by the time the federal government charges you with these sort of things, they got the goods. I don't know.
Direct. I don't know. Maybe I'm naive, but I'm like wishing upon a Christmas star. I don't need socks. I don't need shoes. World peace can wait until 2025, I guess. I want Diddy to go to court because I'm nosy and I want to know what happened. So I'm not even going to receive that he's not going to go to court. I really want him to have the arrogance because I want to know what's going on. I'm deep now. I want to know.
Yeah, I think it's no way. I think that he will not. I think that he'll do better cutting a 20-year deal with the federal government because I think you get a woman on that jury. You get some people with kids in there. I think that there's no combo of jury that doesn't have this man spending 2 lifetimes in prison. So I think he got the deal, but we got one lawyer on the podcast. So what's up?
I feel like the witnesses in this case, who we know, are all subrilities. There's no way they're going to let this man do this trial. I'm sure his phone is blowing up right now being like, you got to take this one. Because, I mean, I think the culpability of others is really what is the pressure for him now. Because it is so many people potentially that knew about this or that modeled this behavior for him. One of them's living in Indonesia right now. And also the feds don't typically go to trial either. That's not the thing. It is like they got everything they need. So really it's backing him into a wall and into a corner and saying, what are you going to take? So I don't know, but I haven't looked at anything. I've been so disinterested by this. I think if I had to think about it, I think about even my culpability in this, and I remember when he had those kids walk across that bridge for a cheesecake. Like little things like that where we all were watching, we were like, ha ha ha, that's so funny. Like he really was so abusive. Just like in the 20 years he's been in the public eye. And I think we all, you know, I mean, even just like as a, you know, somebody as a sort of fan or a consumer of music and culture, there's at some point I was like, I'm over him, ill. But there were so many years with he just was produced so many records. He was so revered. He was given awards. And it's like, it's the patriarchy, obviously, but it's a little bit of those of us who are doing the work. And I think that there is some thinking to do around what do we do or how do we use our voice in little ways in our own sort of ecosystems and in big ways with celebrity culture to say this enough is enough.
I haven't been as deep as you, or not even as deep, but like as disciplined, because I'm just like really fascinated, and it does feel like, and I know I feel like I've seen people arguing about this, but for me it does actually feel like the end of an era. Like it does feel interesting that somebody who came into hip-hop after that kind of era of Arrested Development and the Fugees and De La Soul and really came in and made hip-hop music into a marketplace and really changed everything to be about, you know, his song all about the Benjamins, and to see the conclusion of that thought form, of that way of thinking, is really 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 deeply just it's just too fascinating for me. And the other thing that I've been trying to map out in my head too is, and it kind of is linked to the Janet Jackson story as well, is some of these stories are so wild, right? Like 1,000 bottles of baby oil, 1,000 is so ridiculous. And these accusations are so ridiculous that some of the conspiracy theories that people get red-pilled about and what actually people are being indicted for, the space between them are not that big. So then it becomes harder to say, oh, they're not doing anything to children in no Pizza Hut. Where I'm like, well, maybe it's not in a Pizza Hut, but apparently they still doing something to children. And I'm like, and then it makes me question my reality to the point where I'm like, well, please tell me if you're using, you know, baby's blood as Kool-Aid, because I don't want to go and say that's not happening because it sounds ridiculous, but it is happening. Like, that's the space that this brings me to that is even harder to... And of course, what made me think of this is because Diddy was so involved in Vote or Die. Diddy was the first person who, in my memory as a 33-year-old, my first memory of an artist who I cared about or a representative of a world that I cared about, using their fame for political democratic activation. And now he has been seen to do this. And this is the exact kind of conspiracy that people who are... extreme right say that happens, and I think that has to be addressed and thought about too when it comes to the situation.
You know, when you said that about conspiracies, two things came to mind. One is that what's interesting about the Diddy thing to me, like you said, is the sheer wildness of the true things we know to be true, like blowing up Kid Cudi's car, right? It's like, how many people in entertainment were just afraid of you for so long? And now what happens when that is not the case? And, you know, they're all like, I don't know if you saw August Alsina's post. Somebody was like, where's your next album? And he was like, one day people will realize just how dirty the industry is and how malicious and da da da. And it does feel like hopefully this undoes that, you know, just like Weinstein was the end of like an era of that old magnate bully making people see what I'm doing. The other thing, and DRI, you must have seen this. Miles, I didn't put it in the chat. I don't know if you saw it. Olivia Nuzzi, is that her name? With New York Magazine, who was having an affair with RFK Jr.
Hey, yeah.
And then covering RFK Jr. for New York Magazine. So it comes out that she's having an affair with him. Mind you, he's 70 years old. She's 30-something. So her fiancé, they break up. And New York Magazine has to suspend her. Mind you, she's written unbelievably critical things of Kamala. She's propped up RFK as, you know, I can't believe people aren't taking him seriously. And here she is, and she has a tweet being like, why do people accuse women of sleeping their way to the top in journalism, da da da. Mind you, she's having an affair with one of the guys running for president, and she's covering him. To now her ex-fiance is taken off of covering RFK in Politico. But it goes to what you said, Miles, where like the things that are true are so crazy that sometimes you're like, well, you know, maybe it's all true.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
I'll start with the news. So mine is about Eric Adams. So, Eric Adams, it's been a long mayoralty. Luckily, the election's next year. I do not think that he's going to survive this election. But I just wanted to note, the New York Times has a great tracker if you're interested. There are 18 people in his orbit who are currently being investigated by the federal government. You might have seen that the police commissioner, Caban, the old police commissioner, all his devices were seized. They took documents. And then they installed an interim head of the police department who used to work for the FBI. What you might not have known is that this past Saturday, mind you, he's only been interim for maybe 7 days. This past Saturday, the federal government raided his home. And they took some documents and all this other stuff. He released a statement saying that the FBI raided his home for something that happened almost 30 years ago. Mind you, this is the interim police chief who's supposed to be cleaning it up. They've also raided the home. They've also have a federal inquiry into his former chief fundraiser, the chief of staff under the former police commissioner, some police officers, the chancellor of the school system, who is in a relationship with the first deputy mayor. Her phone was seized. His phone was seized. The deputy mayor for public safety, his phone was seized. Winnie Greco, fundraiser. It is just a mess. And Eric Adams was accused, his administration was accused of, you know, if you have liquor license problems, stuff like that, and the police are coming to shut down your bar or whatever, the NYPD at the highest level, it was a police commissioner's brother who's a former police officer, they were running a racket where if you paid them a couple of thousand dollars, they would get the NYPD to leave your business alone. One of the guys they tried to shake down is on the news being like, they came by my house, they came by the office doing this, da 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 da. Apparently has video footage of them trying to shake him down, which is how this all unraveled. So I just wanted to bring it because it's wild. And it reminds me that, you know, people are working really hard and paying taxes. And then this is what happens to it. You're like, this is, we need inspector general's offices. There needs to be more oversight of these roles. And I wanted to bring it here because it is just insane.
This is wild. Mind you, I am still, there's so many reasons to be upset with Eric Adams. But, you know, I'm no different than most people. Once it gets on my doorstep, then it becomes more personal. And I will never forget the day that I woke up and every dispensary was closed. And I thought, out of all the nothing that you're doing, why was this the thing that you attacked? And then for this to come up and for this to investigation to be happening, I'm like, yeah, every Eric Adams has to fall. Like, I'm so glad about this. And I hope that, you know, come the next, when it's time to elect, I hope New York makes a better decision. And I hope all this reporting helps it be like, he's just not an option when it comes to the next candidate, because he's horrendous, horrendous.
This tracker is so good. And there have been so many stories on these people. It's like there's so many hyperlinks and then you click to the hyperlinks and it's like literally six stories. Like I'm reading about this guy, Timothy Pearson now, who got into an altercation at like a shelter for unhoused people, but like got into an altercation with like security and people like just running amok. Like, and it's just, and then you go to another link and it talks about, there's another story about how actually a male police officer reported his treatment of women. That's how bad it was, that a man actually had to be like, you know what? That's crazy what you're doing over there. I just feel like birds of a feather flock together. So it's sort of no surprise that like, this is his crew. It's almost like, it's not like, I shouldn't say this, this is not a fair comparison, but it's like when you look at Trump's former everything now, like there's like 16 of them that have been indicted. It's really, you know, that these people still clearly have the same sort of value system. And I think the thing that is, that you put in the chat too, Duray, earlier this week, or maybe it's connected to this, was that all of the people that have gotten these like $1 million contracts that have no business getting them, and that it's just because they have, you know, sort of a close relationship with this mayor or somebody in the administration. And in all this, the city is in need of help.
Rats galore.
Galore.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Apartments, $10,000 a month.
Yeah, like it's just
wild out here.
It's becoming,
well, out there, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what a mess. What a mess.
I have a question. Do you all think that within our lifetimes, there will be a moment where being a politician wasn't like a get rich quick scheme or like a get rich plan? Do you think do you think that's possible to go to an era where that kind of, you know, like, I'm just wondering if the internet, the news cycle, could we be moving towards a more transparent future where people who have these dubious motivations don't?
I mean, exist? I think that's right. And I think, you know, and that's not to take it to the convention, but I think there was such good representation at the convention. Like, I do think we have elected officials who are every single day doing the right thing, trying to do right by people, et cetera, et cetera. I think Eric Adams in this administration is such an egregious example of but it's also, we got to remember, a lot of people did not, I mean, I'm sure if we looked at voter turnout right now for the last mayoral, we would all be shocked and appalled. Mm. You know?
Yeah, I do think too that there is, I think that this will usher in, Miles, like more checks and balances. Like, I think that people are starting to realize, like, giving mayors absolute authority at the local level doesn't work.
Right.
you know, like those. So, you know, I think about a lot of the oversight boards in New York City, which structurally have a lot of power. The mayor appoints the voting majority. You're like, well, that's a bad system, you know. But let's move on.
My news today is sort of the context of it is South Dakota. And it's about grocery stores and what's happening to small grocers in this country, particularly in rural areas. But it's happening everywhere. And DeRay, it's, you know, we've covered this in terms of like the Dollar Tree and Dollar General and how they're coming in, and the impact that that's having on smaller grocery stores and small chain grocery stores and sort of decimating them. But I just, this story really spoke to me because, you know, so R.F. Boucher, I think is his last name in terms of how you pronounce it. But he's the owner of Boucher Foods in Pine Ridge on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. And so he's struggling with high prices, supply chain issues, lack of purchasing power, because he's competing against big chain stores like Walmart and Kroger. So Boucher Foods, it's the only full-service grocery store for a region where unemployment is high and more than half of the population lives in poverty. And so it's a grocery store, but it's also sort of like a community pillar in many ways, because R.F. Boucher also, you know, is donating to giving people food when they can't afford it, really. And the other thing he does is like, there's, you know, the week before you get your food stamps, he gives people like little gift cards or sort of, you know, figures out a way to get them the groceries they need in that short little period of time. He sponsors local charity events and, you know, sports teams, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's also something to think about with these chain stores and how they do not necessarily sort of embed themselves with the community and become in community with these folks, right? Because, and I think why this story is speaking to me so much is because I've just been on such sort of a health and wellness kick since my dad passed. And food is so important to our sustenance, obviously, but just to our health. And if grocery stores like Boucher Foods are not able to exist and people don't have options for good food, and the good foods are becoming too expensive to actually buy because of Kroger, Walmart. Also in this article, they're talking about Amazon, and then it's like, oh, remember, Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post. Awesome. So I just wanted to bring this to the pod because it's like, it's one of these things where it's like local issues, but then it's also reaching sort of this national, you know, sort of this national conversation, because the FTC is challenging a merger between Kroger and Albertsons because they're also trying to come together. And it's, I see this as such a critical issue in America where we deal with so much health crisis, where people are living in poverty, where there's not enough access to good foods, and none of this has to be true. And the reason why it is happening is because people want to make money. So, you know, I don't know. And then I was thinking, you know, if Boucher Foods closes, how that devastates the local economy there. So I don't know. This is me being DeRay on Pod Save the People today with some sad, sad news.
Rain clouds.
But I just was like, this is these type of things. And I think just from, I don't know about y'all, but like, even growing up, I remember in D.C. there being sort of these like smaller corner stores where you would get like milk and eggs and cheese. Like there, you could go to those places. And then, you know, obviously like the Safeways and all that, that, you know, came up. But it's, I'm really worried about this. I'm really worried about this food thing and our people. I'm really, really worried.
Yeah, I'll say, you know, the thing that surprised me, Diarra, that I didn't know until I read this, I just had no clue. It reminded me of how city-centered I had been in my thinking about things. I didn't even think about all the communities where, because of capitalism, they would never open a chain store. You know, like, they would just never open a chain grocery store. So all these communities where the neighbor grocery store is really the only thing you got, and they won't give you a bulk discount because there are 1,000 people that shop there, but Walmart has 15,000 people.
They're setting the prices. Yep.
They're setting the prices, and how the government has not intervened to create any regional, like, there's no policy fix for it. Mind you, all these companies are making $1 billion in profit. Like, they're not going broke. And yet, this is a group of people who are, you know, overwhelmingly either marginalized or just not rich, who live in communities, and they're being screwed on basic things like food. And I had no visibility into this until I read it. So thank you for bringing it.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing this to the podcast, because this is depressing. And, you know, anytime you bring depressing news, it always gives me a depressing answer, because my hunch is always that this is exactly how it's designed to be. I think that there is a desire to see these smaller places become food. In my head, have you seen Sorry to Bother You? So I do really believe, tinfoil hat on, I can definitely see a future where all these places get kind of exploited by like an Amazon type of monopoly. And now that is where everybody has to work. And if you don't have housing, now Amazon has Amazon housing for work, and they pay. Like, that to me, all these ways that we can reinvent indentured servitude, it just seems like it's on its way there. And I feel like that is the plan in these places. And I always think that America, this capitalist, white supremacist capitalist patriarchy does not love poor people. So if it feels as though poor people are being disappeared or being death sentenced while they're still alive, it's because they are. And I feel like the only thing that's going to happen is a corporation like Amazon is going to go there, and now these people have no choice but to sell their bodies and labor to this one conglomerate because there's nothing else there. And I think that's the plan. I think that's the MO. I even remember, I did not grow up, I grew up pretty suburban, rural suburban Georgia. So most of the places I would go to were big places like Walmart. But you know what Walmart did destroy that was wild to me? Destroyed hairdressers in my block. So the Walmart, there would be like this big, I forgot what you call it, Walmart Deluxe or whatever. It wasn't just selling stuff. It was selling clothes, furniture, all that other stuff. And they will, super Walmart. And they would also have these places where you can go get your hair done and go to salons and go get your nails done and stuff like that, which seems like, oh, you can do everything in Walmart. But mind you, what did all the black suburban middle-class people want to go do in suburbia when it comes to entrepreneurship? They wanted to open nail shops. They wanted to open hair salons. So that put so many businesses out of business. So I think there's something just humanity-less about how capitalism decides to spread itself. So yeah, I'm here to bring the light. So this is such an interesting story because one of my favorite jazz dancers is Stars Fell on Alabama. And the one that I know is the one that I grew up listening to was Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong talking about the Stars Fell on Alabama. If you haven't heard that song, it's such a lush, beautiful jazz song. Ella Fitzgerald with her honey smooth voice, and then Louis Armstrong with his raspier voice coming to like undergird her, really talking about, to me at that time, I thought it was just a romantic song. Come to find out, it's based off of a historical event that I find really interesting that I want to share with you all. Mind you, there's some astronomy words that I might be taking some liberties with. So if you are a studier of astronomy or astrology and I'm mispronouncing y'all's words, you know, curse me out in my email, not my DMs. So on the night of November 12th to 13th in 1883, wrote Victorian astronomy writer Agnes Clerk, attempted the falling stars broke over the earth. The sky was scored in every direction with shining tracks and illuminated with majestic fireballs. At Boston, the frequency of meteors was estimated to be about half that of flakes of snow in an average snowstorm. Their numbers were quite beyond counting, but as it waned, a reckoning was attempted, from which it was computed on the basis of that much diminished rate that 240,000 must have been visible during the 9 hours they continued to fall. In Alabama, the Florence Gazette reported there were thousands of luminous bodies shooting across the firmament in every direction. There was little wind and not a trace of clouds, and the meteors succeeded each other in quick succession. Basically, in 1833, November 1833, there was a meteor shower, and people didn't know what it was. What's interesting is by the time this meteor shower took place in the Deep South, where there was chattel slavery, enslaved people didn't know what was going on, so they were looking, and then they reported to their slave owners that the sky was falling. The slave owners come out, see this meteor shower. They don't know what's going on either. They begin to pray, but then they also begin to tell these enslaved people where their families were. Begin to tell these people who enslaved them, and basically the slave owners thought it was Judgment Day. So they wanted to get right with the Lord after, exploiting flesh. There's two reasons why I wanted to bring this story to the podcast. Because A, I never heard of it, and I thought it was really, 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 really interesting. And I'm always interested in how, to me, themes of Afrofuturism and chattel slavery and Blackness always mix. And this feels like such an interesting way into it, into both like futurism and astrology and mysticism, as well as just Blackness and Black history. The other reason I want to talk about it too is because sometimes when I hear people talk about chattel slavery, people pretend like that was just the water. That you know, you were born and this is what life looked like, you didn't know any better. What's the most interesting thing about this story is that if you thought it was Judgment Day but you weren't doing nothing wrong, why are you over here telling people where their people are? Why are you over here freeing people? Why are you over here apologizing to God? This story in itself proves that there was a moral center that was abolitionistic in that era, but it was refused to be engaged with. So these slave owners weren't these elementary thoughtless people who didn't know any better because inherited slavery from their grandfathers and their father's father and da da da. No, they knew it, and they knew once they thought the Lord was coming exactly what to do the right thing. So I want to implore people, you know, need us not. I don't know why I'm keep on saying stuff like this. Need us not. Need us not have a meteor shower, you know, or have this a wild astrological event in order for us to see what's in front of us, you know? And I think that tradition is still happening right now when we listen to Trump, when we listen to the people on the extreme right spreading lies. And sometimes what really frustrates me about it is that they almost get infantilized and, oh, this is just how they are and it's how they think and they don't know any better, or, you know, you don't understand if you grew up in Appalachia. No, I actually do believe, and this is probably the most spiritual, religious thing that I'll say on this like podcast for the most part, I truly believe that there is a moral center in most people. And I think that some people decide to go with it and some people just decide to ignore it. And what we are seeing right now in the extreme right, we're seeing people decide to ignore it. And this is not new, because when people were bodying and enslaved and exploiting flesh for cash and for labor, they knew it was wrong. They knew it was wrong, and they were practicing extreme denial, and they were practicing extreme manipulation when you think about using Bible verses in order to justify it. But in the center of them, they knew, because when those stars started to fall on Alabama, those enslaved African people were told where their families were, and those slave owners decided to call for repentance. So I wanted, this felt like a little fairy tale to me, a little Southern Gothic fairy tale. And I wanted to offer it to our listeners. So A, they can do more, even more research on it. And I would love to get even more weird astrological events. Cause I just would love to know more and more and more about things like this that have happened during chattel slavery, but also just a reminder that a lot of this moral theater is just pretending. People know what's right and what's wrong, but people are just doing what they need to do for money and for power. And that's not new. That's how it's always been. And we don't need Black Jesus to come back in order for people to know what's right. They know what's right now, just like they did then.
I love this. And it's so funny because I'm in New Orleans right now and I was running in Audubon Park today. And one of the things I love about New Orleans and running in New Orleans, especially in places like Audubon Park, is you feel there's just something so magical and mystical about it. And you kind of sort of feel the ancestors and in the trees and in how the sun was coming through the trees. And so what this is making me think of is sort of for the white folks that were like, the world is ending in their minds, and they've essentially been living with misery in their hearts because they've been doing all these things right to human beings.
Right.
But yet, you know, the Lakota people are like, oh, look at this. We're going to reset our calendar year to this event. Harriet Tubman's like, oh, this is how I know I'm following these stars to freedom. Like, even as oppressed people, the clarity and closeness you have to earth and nature, I mean, for my perspective, and I'm obviously looking at this glass half full, but like, what a blessing that is to not be living with that type of misery, to not be on the wrong side of history, to not be on the wrong side of sort of a moral center where you can actually absorb and witness and presence God's goodness and receive it and do something with it, as opposed to it happening and you're like, oh, oops.
And do you ever wonder, because we're both spiritual girlies here, and I'm wondering too, do you think that part of our revolutionary activation should be this reconnection? Because I do think about how Harriet Tubman always talked about how she heard a voice. She always made her directive and her decisions sound like spiritual guidance. Harriet Tubman's story reads like a Bible verse. A book in the Bible. You can see how much I don't read it, y'all. I'm like, verse, chapter. I'm like, whatever they did, however they split it up. But it reads right. Like that.
I think that's right. And I think even back to the, you know, the grocery store story. I mean, we are a people who knew what to do with land.
Mm-hmm.
And now we don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't even know. We're not even comfortable. Some of us like taking our shoes off and putting our feet in grass. I don't want to get my feet dirty. But it's like we getting. And that's why I love sort of this like Black land movement that's happening and people getting to the South and buying and even miles away. We got to get to places where we can have peace of mind so that we can have clarity to be able to be creative, to be able to.
Right.
To be intuitive. The ancestors are here talking to us, but there's so much noise, we can't even hear it.
I think that's so important, to be in a place where you can hear. And I think that is the most valuable thing. And you know, I know people are probably tired of me talking about my move, but it really just has revolutionized my spirit and my mind to be somewhere, to really do an action that's aligned with divorcing myself from being so plugged into hyper-capitalism that I could not hear my own self think, because it's either about making money or doing something pleasurable to relieve myself from what I had to do in order to make the money. And that cycle, and then before I wait, and I never have a time to really generate anything. I never have time to see how the stars are falling in my own life. You know, I think that the universe is always speaking to us, and the stars are always falling, or there's always an ancestor saying something, and we're blind and deaf to it because we are plugged into these noise machines that just want to exploit us. And when they're done with us, you know, hope you got some healthcare, even though we got you not to get it, you know, or, you know, even though we made it hard, you know, so, but yeah, thank you for listening to this story, and I hope that I find some more stuff like this, because I think that it's inspirational and helps. It's a little wash of the psyche.
Who is the badge created to protect, and who does it really serve? From Wondery, Crooked Media, and Push Black, uncover the hidden history of America's largest police force with the brand new podcast Empire City: The Untold Origin Story of the NYPD, hosted by Chinjuri Kumanaiku. This official Tribeca selection reveals the NYPD's roots in slavery and the acts of resistance that shaped New York streets. Chinjuri is a Peabody Award winner who has dedicated his career to exploring how media shapes our understanding of race and policing. As a son of a civil rights activist targeted by the NYPD and a parent raising a child in Manhattan today, he confronts the challenge of discussing and safeguarding against the police. This podcast is a must-listen for anybody seeking to understand the true origins of the badge and the power it holds today. The first half of the season is out now. Follow Empire City wherever you get your podcasts. Binge all episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
And lawyer Jessica Pishko on the pod to talk about her new book titled The Highest Law in the Land, How the Unchecked Power of Sheriffs Threatens Democracy. Now, she's been reporting on the criminal legal system for a decade, and she is the foremost expert on the political power of sheriffs that I've ever met. Now, I learned a ton in this book. I spend all of my time focused on the police, not a lot of time focused on sheriffs. And this book is just an eye-opener. Here we go. You'll learn too. I have the pleasure of talking to the one and only Jessica Pishko, the foremost expert on sheriffs. It is great to have you here.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. How did you start noticing sheriffs, caring about sheriffs? Like, what was your entry to being the nation's expert on sheriffs?
So I grew up in Texas, and when I was a kid, you know, I thought about sheriffs as like, you know, actually I usually thought of Walker, Texas Ranger, like wearing the hat, riding a horse. And so I had this idea of sheriffs kind of like, they took care of places far away, like not in the city where I lived, but, you know, out there somewhere. And when I started looking at, you know, criminal legal system reform, I realized that there were sheriffs everywhere in major cities like Houston and Chicago and Los Angeles, and that those sheriffs there, even though it didn't seem like they had a role anymore, that they had this really important job running jails, and that people were electing basically a politician to be their police and to run their jail. And then as I started to dig into the issue, I found, you know, that sheriffs were doing a lot of other stuff too, that they, you know, serve warrants, they serve evictions, they are the people who would serve like a stay away order if you're in a domestic violence situation. They're the people who sometimes give out gun permits in some places. So I realized it was such an odd thing to have this elected official who usually runs as a Democrat or a Republican that was doing all this stuff. Like, why were we electing someone to do this work that felt like, you know, shouldn't it be apolitical? maybe it shouldn't it be a sort of decision that people make who is a jail and how those jails are rather than a politician?
Is there a sheriff story that made you see that this was more systemic than, I mean, we're going to talk about the book, obviously, but was there like a moment that you were like, oh, this isn't like a one-off crazy sheriff. This is like a whole thing.
You know, a few different stories came to mind, and a lot of them came from sheriffs who honestly were nice people trying to do a good job, right? So you hear a lot of stories like there's Joe Arpaio. There's a lot of the sheriffs I talk about in the book who were like committing fraud and waste and, you know, the Mississippi Goon Squad deputies and that sheriff, right? You read a lot about the sheriffs who are doing bad things. But what I realized was that even when people tried to elect a sheriff who'd do something better, that those sheriffs were first really struggling with a lot of pushback from people in their department. But second, that they weren't necessarily, in essence, doing a much better job. So, you know, I was looking at a sheriff like Ed Gonzalez in Houston, like who, to be perfectly honest, is a really nice person with good goals. And people like other sheriffs on the right have been really mean to him and said nasty things to him, but he still struggles with his jail. He's had a lot of people die in the jail, a lot of violent deaths too. So medical neglect, violence, overcrowding. And so I saw just how hard it was, even if someone went in with good intentions. And that's when I realized it was the office. It wasn't just a person. Another example is in North Carolina, voters elected a handful of black sheriffs. And, you know, most of the sheriffs in North Carolina are white. Most sheriffs everywhere are white. But they elected a handful of black sheriffs, and people worked really hard to elect these sheriffs who were going to not cooperate with ICE. Right? They were going to do better. They're going to be less discriminatory, work on, you know, not having racist traffic stops and not cooperating with ICE. And all of a sudden, these sheriffs in North Carolina said, you know, we really think we need a law that says all sheriffs have to cooperate with ICE, right? Like sheriffs walk around saying, we do what we want. We're elected politicians. No one tells us what to do. And then all of a sudden, they turn around and say, oh, well, we think you need to do what we're doing. So we're going to pass a law that says you have to act like us now, right? And that kind of showed what I felt like was the lie behind the whole thing, right? That sheriffs say, oh, well, you know, you elect us and we're going to represent the people. But then here you have sheriffs elected representing the people and other sheriffs saying, well, no, that's not what we meant when we said represent the people.
Okay. One of the things that I appreciate about the book and your work so much is that I spend all of my time on policing. I know police chiefs, I know the legislature, I know the laws. I don't spend a lot of time with the sheriffs. And I'll tell you, the beginning of the book floored me. When you do the demography of the sheriffs, the footprint, I mean, Pishko, I was blown. I was like, why don't I know this? And this is my work as law enforcement. So I won't read directly from this, but I will ask you, I mean, I'll read some of the things that stood out to me after you answer the question. But I'd love, can you help people understand why talking about sheriffs is not an insignificant part of talking about law enforcement or the conversation about policing that's happened over the last decade? Because I do think people hear and they're like, oh, the sheriff, you know, there's a crazy sheriff once in a while. And then what you do so beautifully is lay out the argument for caring about this in the beginning. And I was blown away.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point because I think like the national conversation has always been about police and police chiefs. And it makes sense, right? Because people live in cities and journalists live in cities and academics live in cities and advocates live in cities. And so they see police chiefs and police. And you have like the NYPD or the Baltimore PD. So, you know, a part of the book is not, it's not to defend like police versus sheriffs. I don't want to set up some like one is, you know, one is better than the other because obviously they're both extremely problematic. But just to give people like an idea of why we should care. So, you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting was sheriff's employees are about 25% of hired law enforcement of sworn deputies, not including like people who are not sworn officers. And of that, though, sheriffs, it seems, seem to make disproportionately high levels of arrests, at least when it comes to misdemeanors. And they also disproportionately kill more people on the street. So that's not including people who die in jails, but rather people who are shot and killed on the street. And this seems to be true across the board, right? It's not like there's some places where they're, you know, some places where they're better or worse, but just generally true across the board that they're killing more people on the street than police are. And so I think that made me think, well, why, right? And that was why I wanted people, even people who don't, let's say, live in the country. I think for a lot of people who live in rural areas, their sheriff is really obvious to them. Like they see the sheriff at church or at the diner, and he might be a big politician, but also for everybody that these sheriffs are, you know, pulling more people over. They're taking people's money. If you're traveling, let's say you're trying to drive across Louisiana, they'll pull you over and take your money. They are, again, responsible for shooting more people. They are doing quite a lot of traffic enforcement. And there's a decent amount of evidence to show that they are more likely to do, you know, racially discriminatory traffic stops, and particularly arrests for things like marijuana possession, which I think most people would say is kind of, right, it's a low-level crime if it's not legal. So I think most people would say, well, that seems unusual, because I agree, in general, most city police aren't doing that anymore.
Now, one of the things, too, from a fact-based pattern that I just didn't know, and then we'll talk about the constitutional sheriffs, which is a core part of the book, also didn't know this was such a problem, is you talk about the states without elected sheriffs. I didn't know. I sort of assumed there were sheriffs everywhere. What happens in those places that don't have elected sheriffs, those states that don't have sheriffs in the way that the rest of the country does?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of interesting, because there's actually, even in states with elected sheriffs, there's a handful of places that don't have elected sheriffs. And this is because the United States of America is a diverse place, and people, right, every state is different, every county is different. So, for example, Miami-Dade County didn't have an elected sheriff for a very long time. Florida just passed a law that said they had to have a sheriff. So they're having a sheriff election to elect a sheriff, even though the people in the county didn't really want one. So they didn't have one, now they have to get one. Where's the county where Seattle is, in King County, they have an appointed sheriff. So their sheriff has been elected and then appointed. So it's gone back and forth. Connecticut actually got rid of its sheriffs in the, I think, late 80s or early 90s because of a scandal. They had a horrific scandal in Connecticut, and the state just decided to get rid of it. They run a statewide system. So all their jails are operated by like a state entity, and they use something more like a marshal service or a state police. And the same is true in Alaska and Hawaii. They don't really have counties. And so they have something more like state marshals or state police that effectively do the job of sheriffs, like policing rural areas.
Okay, let's talk about the constitutional sheriffs. So I had never heard of Mr. Mack, who is a key character in this story. I didn't realize his footprint. The way that you liken it to almost like a Atwater Southern strategy, but around law enforcement, I was like, that makes sense to me. I get it. Can you help us understand what you call the constitutional sheriffs, or what they call themselves? The National Sheriff's Association, never even paid attention to those people before. I was like, oh my God, I'm missing the whole thing. So yeah, tell us, what is a constitutional sheriff? What are they doing? Why do people need to pay attention to this?
So the constitutional sheriff movement is basically a group of sheriffs that are essentially lined with the right. They're generally far to the right, very conservative, and they essentially believe that they are the highest law in the land. So their argument is that the president and the Supreme Court and governors and state legislatures can't tell them what to do. And most of what they spend their time doing is saying that they don't want to enforce various state laws. So more recently, it came to the attention of a lot of people because of COVID rules like mask mandates and business closures. A lot of sheriffs, especially a lot of rural sheriffs, a lot of sheriffs in Texas, decided that they didn't want to enforce any business closures, and they, you know, kind of made a big political deal about the fact that they weren't going to do it. And the other thing they spend a lot of time talking about is how they don't want to enforce gun regulations. And so in Illinois, for example, you had, I think, like the vast 3/4 of the sheriffs in Illinois saying they didn't want to enforce the new assault weapons ban that got passed. And, you know, the thing about it that I've always thought kind of interesting, especially with respect to not enforcing the laws, is that, as you know, if you're talking about police, like, police always have discretion. So they don't have to arrest every jaywalker. They don't have to pull over everybody with a broken taillight, right? Police get to choose. But the thing about these sheriffs is that the laws they're kind of picking and choosing to enforce tend to reinforce white supremacy, which is why I liken it to the Southern strategy. And the roots of that really come from desegregation efforts in the wake of Brown v. Board of Education, right? The constitutional sheriff movement takes their ideas and their ideology and what they think is, it's essentially the proper interpretation of the Constitution from those states that said, you know, the Constitution doesn't say we have to desegregate our schools. And we know that the only way schools got desegregated in a lot of places was because they sent in, you know, they had to send in National Guard to make them do it, right? You had to forcibly require a lot of places to do that. And that hasn't happened with sheriffs. And I think to some extent it's because I agree that people look at it and they say, like, oh, that there's that crazy sheriff out there somewhere. But I do think when you look at these sheriffs who are increasingly fighting, especially assault weapons bans, that you start to see them kind of amassing behind like a certain kind of libertarianism that really benefits white people mostly, right? I mean, as one of the things in Illinois, at least, is most people who are in prison for gun possession are there for handguns, right? The vast majority of people who go to prison for illegal gun possession are, you know, young Black men there for handguns. It's not, wait, white people with assault rifles are not the primary population of, you know, gun arrestees. And so it sort of creates this like really distorted vision of what the law is and, you know, the idea of like who the law is supposed to protect.
And what about Mr. Mack? Can you tell people about what's going on with Mr. Mack? I was floored by this guy.
So Richard Mack,
how did you first come across him?
So Richard Mack was a 2-term sheriff in rural Arizona. And I had come across him because, I mean, look, he's basically like the Forrest Gump of the far right. Every time somebody does something, he's there. So like, Ruby Ridge, he pops up. Oklahoma City bombing, he pops up. Waco, he pops up. You know, when the ranchers in Nevada, the Ammon Bundy family, when they were fighting the federal government, he pops up. When they took over the Oregon refuge, he pops up. So every time there's, you know, a version of injustice against sort of white people, he shows up and says, hey, I have this idea, which is that we should get sheriffs to be constitutional sheriffs. And he had tried in a lot of ways to be a politician, right? After he got booted out for sheriff. And that was a result of him being recruited by the National Rifle Association to sue the Clinton administration over the Brady handgun bill. So that bill, which was passed in the 1990s, was sort of the first federal handgun law. And the NRA realized that the law was really popular and that it was going to get passed. So they decided that they would start suing about it. So they kind of went on like a PR campaign to like fight this bill. And so one of the things they did was get sheriffs to sue. And that ended up in the Supreme Court. And the case, which is called Prince v. United States, so it's named after a different sheriff, Richard Mack printed the case out himself and put his own name in. So he like hands it out as like Mack v. United States in like his own little pamphlet. But the case, the case was written by Antonin Scalia, and the case basically says that the federal government can't force local law enforcement to do its dirty work. And in this case, it's dirty work was running background checks. Now, a lot of that is irrelevant because background checks for handgun purchases are now like electronic. So when you buy a handgun, they just do it electronically and there's no law enforcement involved. But this really got, you know, Richard back thinking that he could be a really popular political figure. So he ran for Senate. He ran for sheriff again. He was on a reality TV show where he pretended to run for president. On this, like, he pretended to run for president. His campaign consisted of, he opposed the drug laws. So he supported legalization of marijuana and also, like, supported getting rid of all gun laws. So he had this very, like, kind of wildly libertarian platform. And when all of that didn't work, he became friends with Stuart Rhodes. And they worked on the Ron Paul campaign together, which is, you know, they very libertarian campaign. They met up and Richard Mack had this idea that he would sort of start to recruit sheriffs to be more supportive, in essence, more supportive of militias. So he and Stuart Rhodes, who formed the Oath Keepers, and a few other militia leaders started going on the road, like talking about how people could form militias and that these sheriffs would be the people who were going to support the militias. You know, they told people what they wanted to hear, right? That they were being attacked by the federal government, that they didn't need to pay their taxes, that they could own any gun they wanted. And kind of like, you know, sort of this idea that like, their, you know, quote unquote culture was under attack. It became, again, really popular when Barack Obama was elected president. These ideas had a lot more salience because there was a Black president. People were feeling, you know, racist and they thought, okay, this does seem very concerning. We think that maybe, you know, people sort of joined up thinking like, okay, we need to form these militias and start doing this. And, you know, the movement didn't get, I think, tons of attention for a while because it was pretty local. It was really, you know, small. It was like rural people forming militias. And folks, I think, didn't see it as a huge threat until 2016 and Donald Trump got elected, right? And then all these groups were excited, right? Because they're finally in power. And so that's, I think, when they started to come more like out of the woodwork and show themselves as like, oh, well, now we have this president who's behind us. And so we can start to like express our ideas more openly. The news became more polarized. There's like more right-wing news. So they had more places to talk, like all those right-wing TV stations and Facebook stuff. And so they started to kind of get more traction, I think, among a broader swath of people. And then when COVID came in 2020, that's when I think they really tapped into things that people were upset about, which then, of course, led to January 6th. So we know that, you know, Stuart Rhodes was an important part of January 6th, and he went to prison for it. But the constitutional sheriff movement has remained, right? Despite the fact that most of the militia leaders are now in prison, Richard Mack and his constitutional sheriffs have stayed, I think largely because it sounds like they're training law enforcement, right? You know, law enforcement have to do a lot of trainings, and we know that there's problems with trainings in all sorts of ways. And this is kind of, you know, training for sheriffs. People don't pay that much attention to what kind of training sheriffs get. And so I think he's been able to fly a little under the radar because he sort of purports to be teaching sheriffs about the Constitution.
That's wild. Is there a group of advocates sort of pushing back on them? I want to talk about jails in a moment, and you do it such a beautiful humanizing job in the story of Lamar Johnson and Ms. Franks and all of that. So I want to talk about that. But is there a group of advocates sort of pushing back against the constitutional?
I think that there's been, there's like two different groups. And this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book the way I did, because there's a lot of people who see constitutional sheriffs as kind of like an extremism problem. So a lot of people who are pushing back against militias, and a lot of them are great groups like the ADL or the Southern Poverty Law Center, right, who have all been like tracking hate groups. They sort of categorize the constitutional sheriffs as like a form of a hate group. and are pushing, you know, they're pushing on the idea that like they're dangerous and we shouldn't have them because they don't enforce the law. And I think that they're right because of their links to the far right and to Stuart Rhodes and January 6th. But one of the things I always worry about is that a lot of these extremist researchers and groups kind of rely on like an FBI terrorism framing, right? So they sort of argue that these are like domestic extremists. And what I worry is that the people see them as sort of outside of the norm, right? That they look at constitutional sheriffs and they're like, well, it's only, right? It's not, it's a fairly small percent of sheriffs, right? It's probably 10% of sheriffs in the core of the group. But I think what's more important is that those ideas that they have, that they decide what laws they want to enforce, that they can't be governed, that you can't, you know, force them into accountability mechanisms, right? They don't want civilian oversight. That a lot of that has just impacted the course of attempting to reform sheriffs overall, right? Like as a whole, I point out in the book, like sheriffs have remained largely an office that is resisting reform pretty successfully. Like in most states, they say, well, you can't reform us. We can do what we want. And people say, oh, well, I guess that's right. And then they sort of walk away, right? And so I think that I don't, like, I worry about the framing that sort of acts like some sheriffs are bad and some of them are just fine. But rather, it's a huge problem with the institution because they just don't see themselves as governable. Like, they see themselves as sort of outside of, like, all other mechanisms of police accountability, which is just, it's just not true.
It's interesting. I ask because you talk about, and this blew my mind, how Mac got hundreds of sheriffs to sign a letter against gun regulation after Sandy Hook. I'm like, right. What? This is nuts.
Right. It's horrible. I mean, it's nuts. And then what, it's kind of unclear what really happened, right? But it does suggest that like all these people were really worked up about, I mean, this is an issue that gets these sheriffs really motivated to join. And you see it now in smaller ways. Like I said, in Illinois, New Mexico was a place where, you know, the governor of New Mexico, she wanted to put a moratorium on open carry in the capital for a few days because of gun violence. And all these sheriffs were like, no, you can't do that. And, you know, I think some of the problem is since Sandy Hook, I mean, to be honest, since Sandy Hook, gun laws have become more lax, unfortunately. Like, one of the things that shocked me looking at it was how many more states have open carry, right? Like, we had Sandy Hook, and now we have the majority of states allow open carry of any gun, right, including kind of rifles. And more states don't require permitting. And then, of course, the Supreme Court came out with their opinion, which seems to justify the idea that, you know, people can carry whatever guns they want and there shouldn't be limits and, you know, all this. And I think it's just, it is interesting how it kind of became like a mainstream idea pretty quickly. And it is true, like most police chiefs don't support more gun ownership. Like if you ask police chiefs who work in cities, like, do you think there should be more civilian gun ownership? They say no. But if you ask sheriffs, like most of them say yes. They think that people should be able to own more guns. They argue it's like an issue of democracy, that people should be free to carry whatever weapons they want.
Now, one of the last topics I want to talk about is jails. So there's a whole chapter dedicated to jails where you highlight Sir Lamar Johnson, but you talk about a host of other families as well who were impacted. And you remind us that one of the most powerful roles of the sheriff is not necessarily patrol, but it is being the person who manages and runs the jail. Can you talk to us about why you think people haven't noticed this, why this is a really big deal, what this means?
Jails are one of those places that I think slides under the radar. You know, there's been a lot of movement for prison reform and changing the way prisons operate and also, right, depopulating prisons. And that has, I think, resulted in a lot of changes to prisons, and people are very aware of prison conditions. Of course, I want to add that it's not like prisons are great, and it's not that all prison conditions are better, but rather people notice them, right? The thing about jails is, one, there's just a lot of jails. Like, there's a jail in every county, so that means there's some, like, 3,000 jails. 85% are run by elected sheriffs, and some are really big, like Los Angeles or Chicago, and some are really small. Like, you might have a jail that holds, like, 10 people. And so people just don't see all the time what's happening in their jail. For one reason, people are often not in jail very long, so people come in and out quite a lot. It's hard for them to, like, build a lot of coalition. But what we do know is that jails are also really dangerous because people come in immense distress, right? They come in, they kind of just kidnap you wherever you are. You come to the jail, however you are. Like, I mean, I watched intake at the Dallas County Jail once. They don't do it in public, but, you know, people come in, they're like barefoot. They're coming down off a high. They're in their pajamas. You know, like, they don't ask you nicely, like, do you want to go get your shoes and medicine or whatever, right? They just grab you, and there you are in the jail. And then you have to try to explain to people, like, what your medical conditions are, also, and all sorts of issues. And, like, one of the things that always struck me reporting on this was just how family members, you know, are calling and calling, like, my son's in jail, my kid's in jail, can you please make sure of this? Like, can you please make sure of that? Like, they're, you know, people with vulnerable family members calling and calling and asking for information, asking to try to take care of their, you know, loved ones in jail. And, like I said, to be honest, like, how poorly they're treated. Like, that was just a common theme, is that family members are treated very poorly. People find out that their loved ones die, like, you know, hours, days later. Sometimes they find out by accident. I mean, I just think it's a horrible way to treat people. Just really inhumane. Like, these people don't matter. Their lives don't matter. And I think it kind of puts this lie to this idea that the sheriff is like the police of the people, right? Sheriffs say, I'm elected by my community. I am of the people, right? I'm here serving you. And yet, their most important job would be taking care of people in the jail, right? Making sure they're safe. At a minimum, a lot of advocates say, like, they would just like people not to die, right? The ask is, like, can people come out not worse than they went in? And it seems like sheriffs can't really do it for a lot of reasons. They don't do it. And so I think, well, that's a lie. Like, if you are the, you know, representative of the people, you care about the people, then why are you letting these people in these jails suffer? I mean, and we also know just recently in the news that there's that sheriff who shot the judge in Kentucky. There's more sheriff news, but we, you know, come to find out that his deputies were sexually assaulting women in the jail. You know, this is something that happens. They let this violence happen. And I guess, like, you know, it feels like something that either isn't being reformed or that these offices are just not capable of reforming. And it kind of makes sense in some way that this wouldn't work, right? I mean, sheriff deputies are, you don't join the sheriff's department because you want to work in the jail. You join because you want to drive a car around and, you know, look cool or whatever. And a lot of sheriff's offices use the jail as their training ground. Like, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department for a long time used their jail. They called it the training ground where they learned about the criminal mind. So the idea was, like, you work in the jail, you learn, like, what bad guys do and how bad guys think, and then they unleash you upon the community, which is just a horrific way to talk about people in jail. A lot of people in jail haven't been convicted yet, especially in the Los Angeles jail. So, like, most of these people haven't been convicted of a crime. If they are in jail, most of them are serving time for, like, usually you're in jail serving, like, a low-level offense, or you're there because you have court or you're getting transported. I think it's worth pointing out that the transportation of people is also really dangerous. Sheriffs are usually in charge of moving people from, like, the jail to the hospital or the jail to the courthouse. And, you know, this is not very well reported on because we don't have a lot of data, but there's a lot of suggestions that, you know, they don't do it very well. people miss their court dates a lot because the sheriffs just, they don't feel like driving the truck that day or something like that. And so they can kind of always blame, right, this idea that people in jail are bad. They just blame the people in jail and say, like, well, they're bad. They have a substance use problem. It's not our fault that that's who's in jail.
Now, you know, you've been on this beat for a long time, and, you know, we met because of the protests, and it's wild to have lived through a decade of the ebbs and flows about policing and mass incarceration. What do you say to people who are like, okay, Jess, I read the book and now I feel like overwhelmed by how crazy everything is? What do you say to those people whose hope is challenged in moments like this?
I think that's a really fair question. And I went through a lot of that working on the book. I keep thinking of what one advocate said to me, which was that everything that happens is the result of a specific policy choice, and that everyone can make a specific policy choice that's different. So what I remind myself is that it's choice and that you could choose different. So, for example, the way jails are run by sheriffs, it's a choice. And people in the community can make a can demand a different choice, right? They can go to their county. They can demand transparency, and they can demand that that's not how they want people to be treated. And I think that that's the thing that gives me hope, is that people can demand better. And whether that demanding better looks like, you know, look, people do different things. Whether that demanding better looks like voting for a different sheriff, which you can certainly do, whether it looks like attempting to remove sheriffs who are bad, or whether that looks like trying to reform the office and eliminate it altogether, which is I essentially argue that we just shouldn't have sheriff's offices. But I think there's a lot of things in between. Sometimes people ask me, like, well, I can't run out and abolish the sheriff's office right now. So what can I do in between? I mean, look, everyone lives in a place where there's probably a county jail. To me, that's the place where a lot of people can start. They can start by figuring out who's working there. And are those the kind of people that should be working there? And should there be different people working there? Like, should we have people who are better at taking care of vulnerable and sick people than who's there? There are people they can let out of jail. Like, do we need all these people in jail? Is the question I think is fair to ask. And so that's where I think come down on it is, like, we didn't get here on accident, right? We got here because people decided that's what they wanted to do. But that means you can get out of it by deciding to do something.
I love that. Where do people go to stay up to date with what you're doing, to meet you one day at a book stop, or to see your next writings? How do people stay in touch with you?
So I have a Substack that's sheriffs.substack.com, so you can find me there. And I'm on social media as Jess Pish, so if you're looking for me on social media, that's where you'll find me.
Boom. Well, Jess, it is an honor to talk to you about the book. Everybody, go get the book. There's so many more stories in here we did not talk about, and you are a star.
Thank you.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy of the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy of the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy of the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.